Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to the College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line. Here's Shahan J. Hiraja and Babak Hayeri.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the College Football Survivor Show. I'm Babak Hayeri with my co-host Shahan J. Hiraja, national college football writer for CBS Sports. We love college football. And before we dive into a great topic, let me remind you that you can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show, where we have video highlights of the show, run polls, and listen to your feedback. Please take a moment to like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. So during the season, we always take a look at the race to the college football playoff champion. But in the offseason, we broaden to some of the bigger issues in the sport, and there are no bigger issues than what's going on in the courtrooms and, to an extent, legislatures at the state and federal levels. These are battles that are shaping the sport, and they already have shaped the sport significantly over the past few years by spurring the arrival of the NIL era and loosening or even temporarily halting rules of enforcement for the NCAA. On top of that, there's active ongoing litigation that could present an existential challenge to the current NCAA model, as well as more localized battles over things like conference membership. This is a topic that could easily go beyond an episode and spin into an entirely new podcast series or into a full semester college or law school course. But for now, we're going to take a top-level look with one of the foremost authorities on sports law, someone who I, as a lawyer and an adjunct instructor of law, respect deeply for his ability to explain complicated legal topics in a way that is accessible to a broad audience. Professor Michael McCann is a professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law and founding director of its Sports and Entertainment Law Institute. In addition to his academic writing, he's co-authored a book with Ed O'Bannon on the latter's battle with the NCAA, been a regular contributor for Sports Illustrated, and currently writes for Sportico. He's been a guest on numerous shows and testified before the U.S. Senate. He just finished a fall semester as visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School. Professor McCann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about all the sort of fun things going on in our world.
Yeah, you know, and I know we were talking about this briefly before we started recording, but has there ever been an era of college sports, or really any sport, so fraught with concurrent cases of this magnitude?
No, this is sort of sports law on steroids, right? I mean, what's going on right now in the NCAA and more broadly college sports is unprecedented. We are seeing a whole system under attack through antitrust law, through employment law, through labor law, through intellectual property law. It's this combined snowballing effect that will lead to something very different from what we have. Now, what it is, what it will be, we'll have to find out. But I think it's worth stressing that the system that we're used to is undergoing radical transformation. And it's a transformation that, unless the NCAA proactively makes changes, which we know they've always been reluctant to do, it's going to be born through the litigation process. So ultimately, it will be courts telling the NCAA, this is the new world that you live in. And you know, I always think the NCAA has sort of missed the boat on this, because they could have easily, maybe not easily, but certainly tried to reform on the fly rather than sort of playing defense. And it's sort of like the prevent defense in football, right? We know it ultimately fails.
I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, obviously college athletics is a unique kind of space, but Is there any kind of precedent for what's going on here in terms of, like you said, an institution, an organization being so reshaped through litigation like this?
You know, one is maybe the tobacco industry. And I would use that as sort of an example where an industry was under fire in the 1990s through state attorney generals, lawsuits and other legal actions that led to a pretty profound change. The pharmaceutical drug industry has also been shaped by litigation. I also think environmental protection, the rise of the EPA and certain environmental laws, similarly OSHA, that occupational safety that wasn't a priority until it became. But these are industries that are, of course, we would think about in a more serious light, right, than necessarily sports. And yet sports has been elevated because of the legal issues, because it really comes down to the treatment of athletes and a model that their student athletes, a term that the NLRB General Counsel believes is illegal when used in the context of denying employment rights. So yeah, I mean, the other industries where this comes to mind to me are, I mean, civil rights laws, right? Let's go to something super serious. The rise of civil rights laws, Title IX, I mean, these are big things. And I think it's, now obviously whether college athletes are paid maybe is less important than things like, you know, equal treatment of people on the basis of race and gender, but it's still important. And it still goes down to whether or not they're being denied compensation unlawfully because they happen to be playing a sport in college, when if they were doing the same thing anywhere else, they would be paid.
It's fascinating to look at all of this and the comparisons you're drawing to those industries. I agree, it's both a little bit humorous only because, you know, in journalism, there's always a saying that, that sports is a bit of the toy department. But at the same time, we're talking about young men and women who are working really hard and just compensation in a situation that that certainly is quite serious when you consider that we're talking livelihoods that can end with an injury and the kind of the surprising moments that and tragic moments that occur in the sports at all times. You know, this is a huge question, but I think you've touched on it a bit, and I don't want to necessarily belabor it, but how did we ever get to this point? I mean, is there one, is this the NCAA's lack of action? Is that what it really comes down to?
I think that is a big part of it, the NCAA really trying to hold on to something. And the NCAA would say they're a membership organization, essentially that the members are dictating, let's hold on to the system. There's sort of inertia in authority, I think, in terms of people that have held positions for a long time that get accustomed to it, get paid well, that view any sort of change as disruptive. But I also think, in a way, the Supreme Court losing the Board of Regents case in 1984, and yet in the course of it getting sort of a de facto exemption from antitrust law, or at least highly preferential treatment in antitrust law in terms of relationship with the athletes, they've held on to that, right? The idea that college sports is somehow structurally different and ought to be viewed in a more deferential way under antitrust law. That was a blessing and a curse. I mean, it was a blessing because it allowed the NCAA to have a good legal argument in different cases, but it was a curse when, most recently in 2021, when the Supreme Court in a 9-0 decision in the Alston case said it's just dicta. That case, Board of Regents, nothing to do with athletes. It was about TV rights. It was about restraining the how often schools could be on national TV. And we know Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, of course, just ridiculed the NCAA for holding on to that case. And I also think a big thing was the Alston case. You know, the Alston case wasn't, none of us really thought of Alston as that big of a case because it was about education-related benefits. It was not about NIL. It wasn't about pay to play. It was about something that we don't really talk about. It's athletes getting money for education. Well, the NCAA rolled the dice and asked for the Supreme Court to take the case, and they got it. I think they thought the court was conservative in the sense that they would romanticize college sports and think, let's go back to this time that probably wasn't ever really there, but that we sort of think in our head, you know, when the college athlete was sort of viewed as something noble occupation. Clearly, that's not what the Supreme Court thought. The Supreme Court thought this whole system is awful. It's exploitive. And what a turn of events in the history of college sports.
you know, I'm curious, like you mentioned, in sort of the 80s and the 90s, there are some precedents that seem to reinforce the collegiate model in some ways. And so rapidly, we've seen this movement to the other side that really doesn't seem to be bound, like you said, by politics or ideology in any sort of way. I mean, what do you kind of credit for that somewhat rapid change in perspective on the legal side?
Yeah, I think there's a confluence of two things. One is the rise of sort of libertarian justice, the idea that we ought to let the marketplace play out as it could. And that view, I think, was clear in Judge Corker's opinion in the Tennessee and Virginia versus NCAA case, and really clear in Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion in Alston, where, to me, the viewpoint was, why is the NCAA disallowing member schools from doing what they want to do, which is pay players, right? That's really what this is driving, this, that in a freer marketplace, colleges could decide to compete and some would rise, some would fall, but it would be, in the view of those sorts of judges, kind of a merit-based system that, you know, if a college wants to play this game, they can. And then concurrently, we have seen, I think, the rise of the labor movement in a way that is important, that we're seeing challenges to whether it be Starbucks or other companies, the idea that the worker is somehow not treated as well. And I think, you know, younger generations than me, that is something that gets talked about more than when I was growing up, for example. And, you know, what we, Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel, when you have Jennifer Abruzzo, sort of a labor rights union person, writing basically the same thing as Justice Kavanaugh, a conservative judge and now justice, that's striking. And they're viewing it from different ways, right? But they come together in the same place, whether it be allow the free market to play out, colleges want to pay players, great, they should, just like any industry. At the same time, you have the sort of progressive labor movement saying, wait a second, why are they not being paid? They're working a job. So together, you get this kind of snowball effect. And I don't think the NCAA has any idea how to stop it.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you mentioned that because, and I'm surprised that, like, at least in sports law, it isn't just called now simply the Kavanaugh concurrence, because it was such a, like, wow, he's going off on one today, you know, when you read it. And as you said, like, he's also like, you know, they could just unionize. And you're like, wait, whoa, you're the one saying this in the process. But, you know, obviously, and it's something I always caution, for example, students and people who aren't necessarily lawyers, that the wheels of justice do turn slowly. But with the, I don't know, the cornucopia of cases that are out there, which do you think at this point poses the most existential threat to the current NCAA model? I mean, because there's so many out there. I don't want to go over each one. Obviously, there's Johnson, there's House, et cetera. But in your mind, which one is the one that could potentially just break everything?
I think the Dartmouth College men's basketball team is the one at the top, in part because it's moving fast. And I think that is, it's sort of gotten ahead on the line of all these cases. The Dartmouth one is moving at a rate that the others have not been able to go at. And if in fact it turns out that the National Labor Relations Board, which I think, if I had to predict, I we don't know, but three of the commissioners on the board are Democrat. And I think it was striking where when Dartmouth tried to get a stay on the vote itself, we saw a 3-1 vote. There's currently one vacancy. We saw a 3-1 vote saying no, there's no stay. And the one dissenting NLRB board member said, well, you know, we need to look at this. This is a huge thing. This is unprecedented. The other three didn't say that, which I thought was pretty striking. The fact that they weren't using that. So if that's true, if we play it out and the NLRB sides with the players, then it will go to a federal court of appeals and maybe the Supreme Court, but it's moving at a rate that the other ones aren't. The other big one, and I think Johnson is still in the Third Circuit. We're still waiting on that. It's taking a little bit longer than expected. But the House case you referenced, I mean, that's going to trial, allegedly, in January. Now, we'll see if they actually ever go to trial. But if it does go to trial, you know, the NCAA warns it could pay could be assigned over $4 billion in damages, because it would be about why are the players not being paid to be on TV? That's really the fundamental question in that case. Why is it that NFL and NBA and WNBA players are all paid when they're on TV, these huge TV deals? Why aren't college players paid? And if in fact the court says, yeah, they should be paid. They should have, not only should they be paid, they should have been paid for a while. And now you got to go back and pay them all. That is a death blow to the NCAA and the power, if we're calling it the Power Five, Power Four, whatever we want to use, maybe the Power Two before long. But, so I would say those two to me, just in part because of timeliness.
You know, obviously there's so much push right now to try to get some legislation through Congress to try to, head all of this off. I mean, from your perspective, one, what does kind of the NCAA need at this point from Congress to be able to head all this off? And two, how would legislation potentially impact some of the cases, especially like you mentioned that House case where there's so many damages that could, you know, stretch back for a long time?
Yeah, I mean, we have seen how many hearings, like a dozen hearings over the last 4 years. I mean, they're covered by media very closely. They're taken seriously, and then nothing happens. And we've seen the same, it's like a script, right? It's like the same scene keeps getting played out with different people playing the roles. And no bill on NIL, which actually in the grand scheme of things is a pretty small thing. If we're thinking about it, you know, this world where college athletes could be unionized employees, NIL is looking pretty small. And yet even with NIL, they haven't been able to get anything out of committee. There's been no vote. And we're now in an election year, a historic election year, where a lot of members are going to be, of course, going back to their districts and or either campaigning for themselves or campaigning for others. What the NCAA would need in some ideal world is a law that says college athletes are not employees, that would preempt it under any federal law, whether it's the NLRA or the FLSA, and would also preempt any state employment laws. In addition, the NCAA would be given an antitrust exemption, a statutory antitrust exemption. The NCAA would also be given control over name, image, and likeness, that state NIL statutes would be preempted. Those are huge. And also that Title IX wouldn't be violated in any sort of rulemaking by the NCAA related to those issues. I mean, I don't know what kind of bill that is. I can tell you what, it's not one that's going to pass, right? And, you know, and not only, even if something like that were to happen, we would then see legal challenges. We would see, for example, challenges that the federal government can't preempt state law in those areas. There could also be equal protection challenges that we're treating college athletes different from others. And college athletes, where there would be racial disparities between college athletes and other students. It is a mess. I mean, look, from a law professor standpoint, there's a ton to write about, a ton to talk about with students. It's great material. But from the standpoint of like living the world that the NCAA lives in, I think they have misplaced priorities going on the legislative approach. I think they would be honestly better off cutting deals, settling, find solutions. If they don't, it's going to be courts telling them what their world is.
You know, just to, real quick for me and for the listeners, can you take us to the granular level? What exactly does antitrust mean as it relates to the NCAA?
Yeah. So the antitrust means this. The NCAA is a membership organization, right? We know that. They've got 1,200 members, mostly colleges, some conferences. All of those members are competing businesses. That's the key point, right? The schools we've gone to and work for compete with each other. How do they compete? They compete for faculty. They compete for students. They compete for grants. They compete for marketing. They compete for alumni donations. So even though we think of schools sort of differently, at the end of the day, they're competing businesses. When competing businesses join hands to restrain how they compete, that presents an antitrust problem. Not necessarily an illegal act, but it presents an antitrust problem. Because under antitrust law, we do not like competing businesses, whether it's two colleges or the gas station on one side of the street and the one on the other, or Amazon and Walmart, or two media companies, or two airlines, whatever it may be. Once they start sort of joining hands, there are anti-competitive actions. And what are the effects of those anti-competitive actions. Usually we think of it on a consumer basis, you know, that competing businesses join hands to restrain how they compete. And so we pay more for products because they're not competing, or they don't innovate as much, or our choice of what to buy is limited because there isn't the same set of incentives. In the college space for college athletes, it's this. When colleges get together to say, hey, here's the deal, we only pay a grant in aid, that's it. That means there are athletes who would be paid more than a grant in aid. When I remember Jameis Winston was recruited, right? What could he have been paid out of high school? A market value scholarship for him, maybe it was $1 million. I don't know. Maybe more. Who knows? But it's more than what he got. So the legal issue is this. These are competing businesses saying, hey, let's not compete in terms of paying athletes. And yet, what do we see them do? We see them spend money on everything else because they have this. They can't pay the athletes. So what do? They pay the coach, the big name coach. They pay for the best facility. They pay for the new health care center, the new trainer, the new track, state-of-the-art equipment. Go down and down and down and down and down because they can't pay the actual player. So they pay on everything around them. And that's fundamentally the antitrust issue.
You know, it is interesting to hear, just kind of going back to the legislation, Hail Mary, that it feels like, because even I was joking when we were kind of talking about the congressional or the Senate roundtable, however they were phrasing it, with Senator Ted Cruz, and how he even said, oh, well, we're down with 50-50 chance. And I was like, that's the most optimistic number. That is the guy who just went through all of that, bringing everyone together. He doesn't want to say it's actually a dead issue. He wants to sit next to Nick Saban at the table. Oh, my goodness. I mean, and that dog and pony show is its own thing. You know, we did also look at that NLRB-related House hearing that was going simultaneously. And the testimonies that I found interesting was listening to Mark Gaston Pierce and his written testimony. For he was, of course, he was the former chair of the NLRB when they had initially denied the Northwestern bid to unionize over the fact that it was again and a competitive nature. They were only private school at the time. The NLRB had never thought about conferences. Now, obviously, there's been a lot of changes, and I thought I would turn back to that only because, as you pointed out, it is one of the more, I mean, I love how, as we said at the outset, this is such a rapidly moving area. I don't think anyone, you know, 2 months ago thought we'd be, oh, hey, how's that Dartmouth basketball team going to break the system? But it was interesting to see kind of the cases he brought up. Now, I know he was skewed certainly towards through his own biases, because, I mean, now he's a visiting professor at the at Georgetown Law and the Workers' Rights Institute. He's got his own thoughts on this. But at the same time, he talked about the evolution of the decisions in the NLRB, cases like the Brown Ferris Industries decision, which could have a joint employer status, which is why we see that USC Pac-12 NCAA extension being argued right now, as well as the Columbia University case that brought up a private university and the employers and the faculty being allowed to unionize. However, I did note that there is another one out there, this Bethany case, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Bethany University case that I know that one of the people that was trying to lobby for congressional legislation, I believe it was the St. Joseph's AD, she brought up that there could be circumstances where some of the NLRB rulings out there could create conflict. And Bethany College is a religious college, and they said that they had an opportunity to prevent those from necessarily unionizing. Is this NLRB case for Dartmouth as clean-cut as sometimes we see it reported? Because I mean, I think, and this is something, again, I caution people, you know, when lay people report, they tend to go, oh, you know, they'll read the complaint and say like, oh my gosh, this is what happened. And you know, as lawyers, we're like, okay, hold down. That's the most biased piece of writing. And as a lawyer, we're proud of it when we write them, but at the same time, it's not accurate. How much of a slam dunk case does it seem like for Dartmouth, or is it more nuanced than that?
I think it's more nuanced, and it's, you raised such a great point about the media reporting on a complaint, right? It's always people just buy into it like it's some retelling of history, and I'm glad you flagged that because I feel like I see it a lot, and you see it a lot too, and I think it's an important point beyond the stuff that we're talking about, just in terms of like, you know, journalism in general. But it's not a slam dunk because we don't know. I mean, look, you raise a number of key points that create uncertainty. I would say this, it's kind of brilliant that the effort is going through the Ivy League because they're all private schools, right? I mean, Northwestern, of course, plays in a conference where the other schools are public, and public schools are governed by state law rather than the NLRA in terms of employment matters. That issue gets sidestepped, at least at the conference level, with Dartmouth saying, hey, everyone in the Ivy League is basically the same. No athletic scholarships, private schools. If you think we're employees in one of the teams at one of these schools, presumably the same would be true of others. It's a simpler case in a way. And I think simplicity can help because it creates less opportunity to draw distinctions between, oh, how are you going to have employees at one school and not the other? But we also don't know because whatever the NLRB does will go to a federal court of appeals, presumably, right? I presume the loser will petition a federal court of appeals, and this could end up before the Supreme Court. So, at those levels, I imagine these other issues, whether it be how grad student teachers are classified as employees and whether they can unionize, the role of religious-based schools. I mean, there are all these sort of nuances that could potentially throw curveballs. But I do think the Dartmouth case is simpler. The players aren't seeking joint employment. That's the other thing. I mean, that issue is not part of it, as it is with the U.S. football and men's and women's basketball player NLRB matter. It doesn't make it better or worse. It just is kind of a smaller universe to look at. And I think that's part of the reason why it's actually moved at a faster rate.
You know, obviously some of this is unknowable, but when you look at the precedents that we talked about at the beginning and you look at where things are going now, when you look a few years down the road, 5-10 years down the road, I mean, where do you think this is going and how do you think it's going to be figured out?
Well, I think we're clearly going to be in a world where college athletes are paid. They're going to be paid. Certainly college football players and probably college basketball, both men and women's players, I think will be paid in some sort of form. And immediately the question is going to be, what about Title IX? You know, schools still have to follow Title IX. And if that means that other athletes are paid as well, then that will mean other athletes are paid as well. I think we'll continue to see conferences, especially as they consolidate. I think they're going to become much more autonomous. And maybe they don't formally break off from the NCAA, but let's say we get to a world where there are just two big college football conferences. Call them whatever you want, but they're basically leagues, right? I mean, look at, it's like AFC, NFC. It's like Eastern Conference, Western Conference. And I think in that universe, the players are paid. And I imagine we'll see a private equity play a role in this. I think there are a lot of entities out there that are not yet front and center, but will emerge with a pretty important role to play in college sports. I think, you know, the notion that these are somehow amateur athletes is gone, right? Even when people say student athlete, I sort of like react, like, are we still using that term? It's so antiquated. And I think people need to accept it, that we're going to a different world where athletes are paid. And you know what? People will still watch. I look at NIL. I remember, like, NIL, nobody cares. Nobody cares. If anything, college sports are more popular now than ever. And I don't think that's going to change at all. I think actually getting more business people in the room might actually make it even a better product. I mean, we're in a world where it's NFL college football, right? I mean, if we, you know, look at the, if we're ranking like where things are in American sports, nobody, it's not going away. It will only get more popular. Yeah, the players will get some money and people will be fine with it.
You know, I know we have you for about 30 minutes and I want to respect the time, but there is one question I've been wanting to ask, and it's one where I think Because I mean, we're obviously focused on the revenue generating athletes, the football teams and the college basketball teams, usually the men's basketball teams at the top level. But we know the NCAA has, I think it's like at all levels, 20,000 teams and 500,000 athletes. And then there's NAIA, there's JUCO, there's all these other athletes that we actually don't talk about that add up to significant numbers. I agree with you, by the way. I think we're inevitably heading to employment status for at the very least a top. But what are avenues that could save I guess, for lack of a better word, the Olympic sports? Those folks that compete in things that are important and you know, especially every 4 years, we really care about them because then we see them compete in various parts of the world. But how do we... Are there models that could protect them? I don't know, a club model or, you know, any other level of trying to preserve them?
Yeah, I think one question to me is sort of the threshold question of every college says they're losing money on sports, right? We've seen that talking point, and maybe they are, but I think there's some question about what they're counting. And I know in the Dartmouth case that came up a lot in terms of what's actually counted towards profit and loss. But it's an important question because if a school says, well, you know, we're losing money on this, we have to cut it. What is the value they're getting that's not direct, including, for example, access to alumni for fundraising purposes, marketing, enrollment, right? Enrollment management, looking at the impact that a sport has on admissions. These may be harder to quantify, but nonetheless, extremely valuable benefits. And schools are going to, I think, have to do a little bit more math before they sort of reflexively say we're losing money. So I would begin with that. And secondly, if we do enter a world where, in fact, colleges say, you know, we can't afford to pay the volleyball team and the tennis team and track, and that's okay. I mean, they could convert the teams to club. Now, they can't do it to avoid employment status. They have to be cautious in how they do it. But if they do it in an approach that makes sense, Tom Ferry at the Aspen Institute has written a lot about club sports, and I would encourage everyone to read what he's written, that it is a viable model that actually resembles what the NCAA says is happening in college sports, right? The student-athlete model. They're largely run by students. There's some faculty involvement, some staff involvement, some funding. They play other teams. What about athletic scholarships? Well, most college athletes don't get athletic scholarships. I mean, I think there's that issue, and many of them are partial scholarships. There's tons of scholarships available for all sorts of things. I mean, there are companies that... And I Googled it. There are literally companies that can find you scholarships or at least identify where they are. So it isn't as if eliminating a sport means somebody that would have gone to college on a partial scholarship can't get a scholarship for something else. It's obviously a different world. And again, nobody likes change. And I understand that. I mean, I don't like change, right? Like, I mean, none of us like sort of the world shifting on us. But I think it's a world that colleges can handle. They handle all sorts of serious things. They're very bureaucratic. There's an enormous amount of process at the college level, at the university level. It isn't as if these are like sort of fly by the pants entities. They're to a fault bureaucratic. And I think they would be able to make changes that preserve these sports, maybe at the club level, without the world collapsing.
That is absolutely fascinating. You know, you got me just thinking. I'm friends with the college club. There's a college club sports football league in the end. Like, it's outside of the NCAA. They're student run, and I'm friends with the coach of the Ohio State club football team, which is unsurprisingly quite good.
Yep.
And they have like I just realized they have a poster child out there because one of their guys has actually got accepted to be to try out for the NFL. And I'm thinking like, oh man, that kid might be. You know, hey everybody, look at him. Oh my goodness. But on that note, sorry, you just got my, I love when you know, your brain gets thinking, you're like, whoa, you know. Thank you so much, Professor McCann. It was a pleasure having you join us again, or join us at least on this show to talk about so many issues. I mean, there's so many things we could still talk about, but that's what makes it so delightful, and it's you know, lots of material to write about indeed, academically and otherwise. For those of you out there, again, Professor McCann is at the University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law and founding director of the Sports Law Institute there. You can find his writing on Sportico. I'm going to tell you, anytime he writes something, I read it. I encourage you all to follow him on Twitter and to follow all his writing there, because it is absolutely one of the best ways to get a sense of what's actually happening on some of these legal issues. In a ways, as we were talking about earlier, it stays away from the from that oh, hey, the plaintiff's attorney said this happened, therefore it happened. No, you'll get a more balanced view, a nuanced view on it. So thanks again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Talk to you guys soon.
Well, on behalf of all of us here at the College Football Survivor Show, I wanted to thank you. You know, but before we drop off, Sean, what were your thoughts on that conversation? I mean, I hope it was. See, for me, as a person with a legal background, I hang on every word, because that's what he spends his time doing all the time. Did you get anything out of it yourself, or?
Oh, most definitely. I think that the comparisons that he made at the beginning to the tobacco industry, that was a really interesting pull. I hadn't really thought about it like that, right? I think we naturally sort of think of things just in the realm of sports. So we've heard maybe the antitrust stuff with the NFL before, with the NBA before, but to kind of hear, oh, well, the tobacco industry was one that was basically restructured through court action in a lot of ways, I think that that's a very interesting way to look at it. I think that coming out of this, I'm even more pessimistic about legislation being able to fix this. I think that that he brought a lot of great perspective from that perspective. And so ultimately, you know, I'm going to be fascinated to kind of see, does it end up being settling out of court, like he mentioned? Is it going to be, you know, some maybe government action mixed with some settling? But I mean, this is such a quagmire for the NCAA at this point, just with all the different issues that that Professor McCann brought up. And ultimately, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to get out of this one, man.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I enjoyed your question asking him to compare it to, because I'm just thinking like, boy, that's a PR nightmare if you're the NCAA. You know, like we're being compared to the tobacco industry.
Tobacco industry and sports.
And the nicer of the two is the pharmaceutical industry. I'm like, those are not great things you want to be compared to, because they've had moments, even the pharmaceutical industry, which purportedly is trying to help us, has had moments of where they kind of said like, you know, maybe you shouldn't test these things, or maybe you should test them more before you release them onto the public. So, yeah, wow.
Do you think that Charlie Baker, when he took over the NCAA, knew that he'd get compared to Richard Sackler? Like, do you think that was a draw of the job?
You know, I admire him for taking the job, because he had to have gone in with open eyes. And one thing I wanted to ask him about, but I knew we'd run out of time, was the Baker proposal. Because the thing is, I don't think, while it would be, they're trying to separate the moneyed the sports and try to give them their own entity to create competitive nature, because that is going to what Kavanaugh was kind of alluding to in his concurrence, that, you know, we need some level of competition. That's why he was even willing to say, like, you guys could organize like labor, which, again, really bizarre coming from Kavanaugh, given his background. And one of those things that came up was, I don't think that's going to prevent those not included in this new division from still suing. I think you could still end up back to where we are exactly right now, except we have the players on, you know, what we now recognize as more of a true minor league of college football and football itself and basketball, as well as the non-revenue sports also deciding to sue for the same thing. So, yeah, no. Listening to all of that, it just really confirms that we are in a situation where I agree with him 100%. We are going to have employment at some point, at some place. What I was also most surprised of is his view that this NLRB case with Dartmouth may be the fast one. And when he said it, it made sense to me. I think not obviously paying every moment of the day to this topic. I hadn't thought about it, but he's absolutely right. That NLRB case, with the way it's structured, is going to move faster than some of this litigation. Because as he said, Johnson and House, we've talked about it for, I think, a couple of years now. And those two cases are still we're still waiting for them to move forward. As he pointed out, I love it, because he phrased it as an attorney. He's like, well, it's about to go to trial in January. I'm like, that's like a long time from now for us.
It's 10 months.
For us normals, you know, it's going to be a whole other season. My goodness. But yeah, no, that was great. And, I learned a lot, and I hope those of you listening also learned a lot out there. Well, I think that's a good moment to kind of wrap this up. I just wanted to thank all of you for listening. I wanted to thank our producer, Joey Aliberti. Be sure if you get a moment to like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show. He's Shyam J. Raja. You can find his work at CBSSports.com as well as at Shyam J. Raja on X and TikTok. I'm Bob Akhayeri. Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great day.
The College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line.